Fellow members, in my brief talk at the reception, I referred to the unique family relationship which exists between so many members of our society and of the great kindness that finds expression amongst us wherever one goes. I wish to add, if I may, a few words more. As far as Sandra and I are concerned, I'm quite familiar with this. All over the world. And worse. Now try. I'm only honored you wish to record. I remember in America once, I had so many microphones here up in front of me that I said, "Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow microphones." Now, is she ready? All right. What we both wish to say, that this great kindness, brotherliness, and family relationship between our members is so very markedly apparent here in New Zealand. And the many activities in which we are able to be engaged have been made possible by the most generous and unexpected provision of a most comfortable home, almost completely furnished, 17 Belvedere Street, Epsom in Auckland. There, we daily express our gratitude, and I repeat it now, there in the privacy, seclusion, relative quietude of a no-exit road, yes, and surrounded by most helpful fellow members as neighbors, there we have been wonderfully provided with the very best conditions in which to participate in the work both of our section here and of the society. In this collaboration, the former General Secretary and his lady, Roma, have also personally been most generously helpful and in bringing this about. And so also our new General Secretary, who is a valued and helpful friend. And so, Sandra and I do wish at this convention to express our deep gratitude for all these very real blessings that have been and still are being bestowed upon us by the New Zealand section and by many deeply appreciated members, close friends, as so many of them have become. And so we do express deeply our thanks for these and other great blessings. And as I sit here now, I feel a happiness welling up within me to be here with you all in such large numbers engaged in the Master's work. For me, the only work I want to do. Now we're going together, sort of quietly, consider the opportunities before us in this second century which we as a society have now entered. If we look forward, I presume our general anticipations, all members being free, our general anticipations as members will be at least threefold. We hope, don't we, that during the second century of our society, its first object will have sufficiently prevailed to assure the renunciation of war as means of settling international disputes. Oh, may we contribute to this wonderful progress in this next 100 years. And then, second, that our second object will have become the foundation upon which the mutual study of all world religions will have become established. And third, that interests so prominent as it is and still more so is becoming, interest in the third object will have brought about recognition that the physical body is not the whole man. Part of the great message of Theosophia, don't you think? And then the knowledge will have been gained of man's true individuality. And perhaps then, in an increasing number of people, the outer and the inner selves of men and women will have been brought into collaboration in the fulfillment of the sole purpose for human existence, which is evolution to adeptship. A wonderful program before us. So I suggest, taught our revered co-founder, H.P. Blavatsky, in books the importance of which will not be exceeded, I'm sure, even in the second century, Isis Unveiled, The Secret Doctrine, The Key to Theosophy, The Wonderfully Beautiful Voice of the Silence, and the 9 volumes of her collected writings, which we owe up to now to her grandnephew, whom I have met several times, collected writings of H.P.B. This we owe to Boris de Zirkov. In other fields, of course, every aspect of the work of the Theosophical Society needs a special emphasis. And here again, if one word might be used to designate one of our opportunities, might it not be the word teach? To continue to teach the ageless wisdom to mankind. Our main privileged opportunity, don't you think? And so we hope that it will be possible to continue with increasing effectiveness to teach pure theosophy and its applications to the problems of human life. This was affirmed by one of the very greatest of the masters of the wisdom, our Lord the Mahachan, who wrote in Letters from the Masters of the Wisdom, first series, these words: we have to popularize a knowledge of theosophy. That may again be personal. When I first read those words, it was as if my whole being came to life and I knew why I had been born: to popularize a knowledge of theosophy. Why? Answers the revered Mahatma Kuthumi: for the amelioration of the condition of man, the improvement, the betterment, the elevation, for the amelioration, he wrote, their purpose, for the amelioration of the condition of man. What a very great call is ours, isn't it? By means of ever more effective and attractive literature, lectures, groups, and personal talks founded upon serious study, and above all, I suppose I ought to say, yes, by means of theosophical lives. How have I got that in my notes? By ever more effective and attractive literature, lectures, group and personal talks, and above all, by theosophical lives. Thus we may hope to win mankind's acceptance of theosophia. It's only hope, as I see the world today, makes me, if I may again be informal, makes me wish I were younger. To be side by side with all those who will teach with maximum effectiveness the great and the transforming truths known from olden days as Brahma Vidya, the wisdom of Brahma, the Supreme Deity; Gupta Vidya, the secret wisdom, esotericism; and Theosophia. Our opportunities, as far as I can see, organized methods whereby these and other beneficent purposes may be fulfilled, consist, so I venture to suggest, of inspiring, educative, and practically applicable literature, lectures, and yes, theosophically lived human lives. Lectures, as you know, has become part of my privilege, and the invention and use of tape recordings and films now bestow a greatly increased audience, yes, and a greatly increased period of time upon an inevitably time-ruled lecture. Tape recordings prove to be a very great help in many ways, including what here are called what? Tape books? Taped books. Lectures are, I believe, the most directly effective. Don't know what you will think, that they bring the teacher, the exponent, into direct personal relationship with audiences. One can become one, wonderfully so, with a whole audience.
Talking books,
yes. And then literature, as I was saying, books based upon thorough grasp of theosophy, books written with clarity of writing, and including practical ways of the application of the various teachings to life. These things, books, they possess the advantage of relative timelessness. Nevertheless, also, lives nobly lived might be regarded as the best propaganda of all. I wonder what you will think of that. Well, whatever one's chosen method, in order to speak and write effectively, may I suggest, one must study theosophy as if for an exam, so that you really know your subject and can answer almost every question. Another personal but very painful memory, if I may share it with you. My first lecture, 1913. Miss Clara Card, the national lecturer for England, or the British section, she had to speak on the life after death at a public meeting. For some reason or other, although I'd only just joined, I was asked to take her place. I went through the books and tried to arrange the subject matter in some kind of logic, and then spoke from these writings. Probably fairly good, since it was not mine. But there happened to be a person in the audience under the name of title of rationalists. And he rationalized me very thoroughly. And everything I said, and I was so new, I simply could not answer his objections and his reasoning. I went home that night very depressed and miserable, but also very determined that I would never again, excuse the personality, I would never again go on the platform on behalf of our society until I had a reasonably sound grasp of the subject. I remember I used to take our subjects, like reincarnation, for example, and myself find every fault with it I could. Make a long list of faults, and then study and write and work until I had the answers. I was living in lodgings as a young man in business then, and able to do this. And so gradually from that painful experience, I learned, I think, a useful lesson, and so I venture to pass it on to you. One must study theosophy as if for an exam, and perhaps one may well submit to and apply training in both writing and public speaking, and so and then to perform both those functions with strict impersonality, the sole motive being to serve one's fellow men. I suppose, yes, I can't put it any better than that, the ideal of lecturing. As an increasing percentage of the 33,000 or more members of adept-inspired parent Theosophical Society undertake these three means of fulfilling the purpose of the Masters, then don't you think that our society in its second century will expand and reach an ever-increasing number of people? And this surely is of supreme importance, because theosophy understood, theosophy correctly taught, theosophy applied to life, is both the sole effective remedy for the world's most serious ills and the assurance of enduring health and happiness for mankind. And until this is done, there won't be any, I fear. A theosophy accepting and applying mankind. Yes, that surely is our great objective for this century. We will. It's being done everywhere throughout our movement. There does exist, don't you think, a danger that some members might permit themselves to be diverted from the direct carrying out of this program, diverted into individual and undue pursuit of personal interests, psychic and otherwise. This could cause one to become less one-pointed in bringing about a theosophy living humanity, the supreme objective, a theosophy living humanity. Now I'm going to advance an idea that has long been gaining a predominant place in my mind, as also, I should say, most probably in yours, an idea that I believe to be urgently necessary, that must be presented powerfully, convincingly, and continuously to mankind of today. I am convinced that an appeal must be made to humanity to reduce and eventually to discontinue, outlaw if it could be possible, the increasing practice of cruelty on earth. Our daily papers and weekly news sources now fill one with horror at the cruelty, the violence that is now being practiced, man upon man, women and children. Humaneness, then, I suggest, is one of the greatest ideals to be presented to the hearts, and if we can reach them, the minds of modern humanity. Increasingly cruel practices and customs that have for so long shadowed world history are now casting a deepening gloom upon the world. Unhappily, too, they are generating a misery that cannot fail to afflict mankind more and more painfully under the action of karmic law. There was a boy got into our plane, boy of about 9, I suppose, with death of planes, and simply didn't want to go on board, and fought against it and shrank against it and called out against it, said, "Please, I don't want to go, I don't want to go." And his father shouted out to him, "If I have to take you back home, you will receive something that you've never received before, and worse." Been bothering me ever since. Perhaps that boy was killed in an aeroplane accident in his former life, and he's brought over a shrinking fear from planes. We don't know. But the cruelty and rage in that father's voice, really, they were terrible. And this is unfortunately all too universal, strangely blended with the most remarkable loving kindness, beauty of life, and increasing organizations for humaneness. But man, I urge, must become merciful, must become humane in motives, thoughts, words, and deeds. More and ever more compassionate hearts are so greatly needed at this time. Deeply felt love and concern for the happiness of all sentient beings on earth must, and I know you will agree with me, must find an ever-increasing place in the conduct of all nations, groups, and individuals. And this is not only for love's sake, the prime purpose, but to prevent what could become a catastrophic descent, already becoming apparent, a catastrophic descent of the karmic reactions brought about by man's continually increasing infliction of suffering upon fellow human beings and on subhuman sentient creatures. You will hear me talking about that on the centenary January the 2nd, the New Zealand Herald. If the United States and the Soviet Union continue the production of nuclear weapons, they will soon have enough arms to destroy each other 100 times. The director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, still quoting, said on January the 1st in Stockholm that the USA and the Soviet Union are now thought to have similar strength in tactical nuclear arms, with each country possessing about 20,000 tactical nuclear arms for use in limited or in battlefield situations. Dr. Barnaby said also, the world in the last year spent $210,000 on armaments. As we now step into our society's second century of existence, could there not be launched, fellow members, under the first object perhaps, and in collaboration with the Theosophical Order of Service, a really powerful world crusade for humaneness? Oh, I so wish there could. Alternatively, could not those who feel so moved, all being free, organize a worldwide campaign for humaneness, born from the hearts, born out of deeply compassionate concern for the need to reduce the extent of deliberately inflicted suffering, now so painfully, yes, and so widely evident throughout our world. What else comes under our opportunity, might I say? May I advance another idea? Another part of Theosophia that might well more and more be included in our presentation. A great master, again the Master Kuthumi, wrote, "Nature has linked all parts of her empire together by subtle threads of magnetic sympathy, and there is a mutual correlation even between a star and a man." For the Kabbalist, I continue, every existing thing is endlessly correlated with the whole of creation. For him too, everything mirrors everything else, beyond which is a reflection of the true transcendence. Excuse me. How nice that I can be informal. Think it, yeah. Eliphas Levi said, "The mystery of the earthly and mortal man is after the mystery of the supernal and immortal one." And the German philosopher Goethe echoes this in his words: "The eye could not see the sun if it did not contain the sun within itself. And how could divine things enrapture us if we did not carry the power of God within us?" The eye could not see the sun if it did not contain the sun within itself. And how could divine things enrapture us if we did not carry the power of God within ourselves? In Kabbalism, this is carried very far indeed. Please listen. In the chain of being, I love that phrase, means everything is linked together. Another of those phrases, one's heart and mind leap on coming to them. The chain of being. So they say this. This is the old Hebrew seers and occultists, remember. In the chain of being, everything is magically contained in everything else. Where you stand, there stand all the worlds. What is below is also above. What is inside is also outside. And everything acts upon everything else. Man is portrayed in Kabbalism as a symbolic transparency through which the secret of the cosmos could be discerned. Man is portrayed as a symbolic transparency through which the secret of the cosmos could be disarmed. Well, that's the age-old teaching which Madame Blavatsky puts before us under the correspondences. Francis Thompson, the English poet who wrote so wonderfully of matters mystical and occult, in his poem called The Mistress of Vision, referring to the awakening of the inward vision by which all this interior interaction may be discerned, he wrote as follows: "When to the new eyes of thee all things by immortal power, near or far, hiddenly to each other linked are, that thou canst not stir a flower without the trouble of like a when to the new eyes of thee all things by immortal power, near or far, hiddenly to each other linked are, that thou canst not stir a flower without the troubling of a star. Thus, occultists, philosophers, and poets perceive, teach, and stress the underlying unity of all that exists, and therefore, all mankind. Surely, a very big part of our message. More? Well, you will doubtless remember how in her day, when she was alive, H.B.B. mysteriously wrote of the existence of one, capital O, whom she referred to as, quoting, the wondrous being called the Initiator. And she went on to write and teach about the path of hastened development and to be associated with people who are treading that path and who had become disciples of one or other of the great adepts. So she says, the wondrous being called the Initiator, Thor, who is the tree from which in subsequent ages all the great historically known sages and hierophants, such as the Rishi Kapila, Hermes, Enoch, Orpheus, have branched off, as objective man, he is the mysterious, to the profane, ever invisible, yet ever present, personage, capital P, about whom legends are rife in the East, especially among the occultists and the students of the sacred science. It is he who still shows the way to that region of freedom and light from which he is a voluntary exile himself, shows the way to every prisoner who has succeeded in liberating himself from the bonds of flesh and illusion. In the early years, as I was saying, and I think you'll hear me saying on the tape that I sent to the centenary celebrations, in the early years and during the lifetime of the co-founders of the society and their fellow members, certain of their close associates were accepted as disciples by certain of the great masters. May I here share my firm and complete conviction that the great masters of the wisdom, the adepts who inspired the founding of our society and their fellow members of the Great Brotherhood, these continue unfailingly to maintain in increasing degree their profound interest in what some members regard as the path of hastened unfoldment. So don't you think it could be a very useful addition to our work to teach about the ever-open pathway that leads to discipleship, to make clear that it may just as assuredly be trodden at this present time by those who faithfully obey the age-old rules, as it was at the end of this world period, for the path of discipleship, we are assured, is never closed. It's open now. And the rules and the laws and the ideals are clearly put before us in our own literature and in that of other movements and religions. So perhaps those lecturers and writers who feel so moved might add to their subjects, if necessary, an introduction more and more of this great subject, that although we may be living our lives openly and visibly, people may be out in the world mixing with their fellows, nevertheless in the hearts of some of them, here and there has awakened a power, a resolution, a knowledge that this inward path is the only one for them to tread. Or, as the Upanishad puts it, there is no other path at all to go. I think so. I'm doing it very delicately and gently in my own small way. Now to close. The great problem before mankind is, isn't it, dividedness. We all think we're separate people. We aren't at all. Oh, it's true that bodily you're over there and I'm here and Sandra's here, but that's all. Otherwise, the same life is alive within each one of us, exactly the same. And it is undergoing exactly the same procedures of unfoldment, development, and its goal for all is exactly the same. Ye shall be perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect, as our Lord put it. It's disunity, it's lack of the knowledge of the fact of this oneness, which is the basic and fundamental truth about the whole one of us. All of us, we are one. And so in closing I ask, Is there one special key to the fulfillment of the hopes I have expressed, that mankind may come to recognize oneness? I answer yes. There is such a key, and briefly stated, it consists of the transcendence of the illusion of separateness. Let me close by reading HBB's own words on this subject from her collected writings, volume 9. She says, "It is a fundamental doctrine of theosophy that the separateness which we feel between ourselves and the world of living beings around us is an illusion, not a reality. In very deed and truth," I wonder if she writes, "in very deed and truth, all men are one. Not in a feeling of sentimental gush and hysterical enthusiasm, but in sober earnest, as all Eastern philosophy teaches, there is but one self in all the There is but one self in all the infinite universe. And what we men call self is but the illusionary reflection of the one self in the heaving waters of earth." She closes. And with her words, I now close. "True occultism is the destruction of the false idea of self. And therefore, true spiritual perfection and knowledge are nothing else but the complete identification of our finite selves with the great all." H. P. Blavatsky.